We are going to start today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 948. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 948 comes to you by sponsored by the Committee on Judiciary at the request of Diageo, and 948 mandates a suspension of driver's license of anyone who sells or gives alcohol to a person under the age of 21 for a period of not more than a year. Allows a court convicting a person of selling or giving alcohol to a minor to recommend to the Department of Transportation that the convicting person be granted a hardship permit.
Thank you very much. We have Bob Douglas here. Bob Douglas, I'm sorry. I read the writing as it looks, even though I know the person. And did you want Chris Gitson to come up with you, or Bernie, or anyone?
We're fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair, welcome. Members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing Diageo. Some of Diageo's brands include Bailey's, Tanqueray, Johnny Walker, also BV Wines, and Guinness Beer. We ask you to support Senate Bill 948. It provides for an administrative driver's license revocation for any adult who knowingly furnishes alcohol to a minor other than the adult's own child or spouse. According to the 2004 Oregon Healthy Teen Survey, 70% of Oregon 11th graders and 29% of 8th graders have participated in underage alcohol consumption. Oregon rates for underage consumption of alcohol are higher than the national average. Oregon 8th graders have a 54% higher rate of use than the national average. According to the same Healthy Teen Survey in 2004, 70% of Oregon minors get their alcohol from friends or other social sources. Underage drinking is illegal and often deadly. Both adults who furnish and underage drinkers need to be held accountable for violating the law. Current state law already prohibits retailers, liquor agents, from selling to minors, and there are current penalties in statute to prohibit that. I believe some amendments are coming that would exempt agents and retailers from the provisions of the license revocation, recognizing there are other statutes in place, and we would be supportive of those amendments. Administrative driver's license revocation is already in place in a number of states. Three states, South Carolina, South Dakota, and recently Virginia, require revoking licenses for adults who furnish to minors. 16 states are currently considering similar laws this year. We've been tracking that progress, and those bills seem to be moving along very well. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. You talked about the exemption for agents and retailers because it's covered elsewhere in the statutes. But there's also, in some of the liquor statutes, there are exemptions for sacramental wine as part of communion or other church services in a religious context. And I'm just wondering if what your comment is on that and whether you would be receptive to having an amendment to exempt those kinds of...
Madam Chair, we'd be supportive of that exemption.
Thank you. I think we'll have something drafted so that we can make sure we are staying on the right side of the law here. Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wanting to clarify that... currently, the law was set up so that it stepped up the penalties based on first offense, second offense, third offense. What you're proposing doesn't do that. It immediately goes to first offense, you lose your license for a year. Why isn't there some contemplation that maybe somebody can... the first time you won't come down on them quite so harshly?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, we feel this is along the lines of sensible punishment. If you look at peer-to-peer, people who are barely legal age providing alcohol to those who are just under, driver's license is a very important thing to those individuals, and we think this is going to have an effect. Oregon has made great strides in terms of monitoring retailers and liquor agents and really reducing minors getting alcohol through those channels. The big thing is getting it from adults who are not their parents.
that it, Senator Ringo?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm satisfied with that, but I understand it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, I'm just looking at how you've done this, and they include both subsections 2 and 3, and 3 is what brings my attention when it says no person who exercises control over private real property may knowingly allow any other person. So, I mean, if I, as a homeowner, and my kids are doing this, and I happen to know about it or something like that, that potentially comes back to me, even though I may not be the one giving them the alcohol. Or if someone else, as a landowner, if I know that there's a party going on my property and I don't do something to stop it, would I be liable?
If it's your own kids, we're okay. If it's every kid in the neighborhood, yes.
But, Madam Chair, I guess my question is, if there's a party going on my property, and I'm not even there, but I know about the party.
Right.
If there's underage drinking going on.
I believe it says the prohibitions of this subsection apply only to persons who is present and in control of the location at the time the consumption occurs.
Okay, so I would have to physically be there.
I'm reading from 15, 16, 17 on the first page.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Well, just to follow up, so that means that, let's say, somebody runs into 7-Eleven and buys some beer for somebody, and that person takes it and drives off and drinks it, then this isn't going to apply because that purchaser wasn't there during the consumption.
No, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that does apply.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess maybe I was focusing under sub 3. It wouldn't apply under sub 3, but it might apply under one
sub
of the
2.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Well, then that raises a question with me. So the parent who buys the keg and puts it in the house and the kids all come and then the parent leaves, they're not liable, it sounds like.
I believe they would be liable if it's anyone other than their own child.
Well, but it says present on the property, present or in control of the property.
Madam Chair, I believe you'd go back up to sub 2.
Okay. Well, let's see. No one.
So give okay. Or otherwise make available.
Okay, so you could buy it and you'd be liable, and then if you were there, you.
Or if you're there, you're liable.
If you were there and with the intent and knowledge that they were going to be drinking, even if someone else provided it, you'd be liable. Okay, all right. Any more questions, Senator Beyer? Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, now we have. Next, Chris Gibson and Bunny Giusto. Sheriff Giusto, your handwriting is so bad I had to figure out who you were from your phone number.
Madam Chair, I usually just write green down. So the green guy, thanks very much. Madam Chair, sure members of the committee, I'm Bunny Giusto, Multnomah County Sheriff, and thank you for your time this afternoon. I guess let me start. The elements of the bill you've gone over. Let me talk a little bit about my 30-year career in law enforcement. With three different agencies and head of two. The issue of underage drinking never seems to change much in this state. It's the decision by minors to drink alcohol with relatively no experience about the result. This bill addresses not their decision to drink it, but how they acquire it to drink it. I can tell you time after time, and I can anecdotally tell you story after story. In my experience, right across the street right here, at Willamette University, which is where I graduated from, was a fight out in a dorm, an athlete, and the issue of underage drinking very much real in my life. Now, you know, I didn't participate in it. But I know others that in our house that bought for juniors and seniors, who bought for freshmen and sophomores,
in party settings, and absolutely, this is a long time ago, I recognize, but college campus issues haven't changed much. When alcohol hits a dorm, nobody's in charge, and nobody's in charge about the decision to drink it, and I'll tell you, nobody's in charge of the decision what happens after the alcohol has been consumed. In a case in Columbia County, it was one that comes to mind around this issue you just talked about, probably late 80s, early 90s, young man was furnished alcohol at a party in Columbia County by an adult who knew that they were drinking on the property, not there, but knew they were drinking on the property. The young man was furnished the alcohol. He immediately went out to a roadway, laid down, was run over and killed. He wasn't driving. He wasn't doing anything, but just decided he'd had enough alcohol. He needed to lay down. Well, he laid down in the wrong place. The person who furnished the alcohol was charged with furnishing alcohol to a minor. If you look at the penalty in that case, absolutely, in terms of the criminal penalty, absolutely did not match what happened to the young man. The civil penalty, I didn't follow what happened after that. If there was any civil penalty, the parents who then I know went on to litigate the issue. In this case, I'd urge you to take a careful look at what the intent of this bill is. It's the message in the bill as opposed to the administrative suspension of a license. The message is this state does not allow adults to furnish alcohol to minors. And we're going to have a swift and certain punishment for that, or I should say not a criminal punishment, but administrative sanction for it. Why that's important is just what we're talking about. It's not whether or not the young person ends up with the alcohol. That may or may not happen. The fact is that we still have allowed a vehicle that it happens much too regularly, and we have no ability, once in the hands of that minor, to make any difference in that person's life. The other issue that I tell you is that my jail is anecdotally is full of males and females, and when you sit down and talk to them, they will tell you that their criminal career started around either alcohol and drugs before they were 21 years old. Everyone in my jail, remember, only has to be 18 to be there. Many of them are there at 18 to 21 years old, well on their way to alcoholism, well on their way to drug addiction, and well on their way to have other people furnish it, and oftentimes they'll tell you who furnished it. So it's not just a matter of feeling bad for somebody because they lose their license, but creating also a generation of people who can't now function in society and for the want of somebody giving them alcohol end up in a criminal setting. I think it's the message here that's important. The result, I think, in terms of people's lives could be impactful. I think Senator Ringo asked a great question, and then I'll close. The question really is why don't we amp up to this instead of hit it all at once? Well, that amp up was always meant to warn minors, about possessing alcohol. We say we have a zero tolerance in this state. That's a different question than an adult knowingly giving somebody alcohol, knowing it's illegal. I don't think they get a chance to have it amped up. They get it amped up right now, and the message is clear. And I can tell you need to be a few of the scenes that we've been to when you see the tragedy that I'm here supporting the bill, not because Senator Brigg asked me to. I'm here because the fact is my 3-year career tells me that we've not yet got people's attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions, the Sheriff? Thank
you.
Senator Ringo.
Right now, somebody has their license suspended for other reasons. They can obtain, I don't remember what it's called, permission to go to work and back.
Right, provisional license.
Provisional license.
Right.
In this instance, would they be allowed a provisional license?
I believe they would. And Senator, I'd have to look a little more carefully at that.
He's nodding yes. That was a typical
one. I believe they can.
Okay.
I believe the bill does allow it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Gibson. I'm the Deputy Chief of Police for the City of Beaverton Police Department. It's my pleasure to be here today in support of Senate Bill 948. Local law enforcement, like the Beaverton Police Department, is frequently called upon by retailers and others in the community to deal directly with the problem of underage drinking. Since 1998, in response to these requests, we've conducted alcohol stings using underage decoys that we send to the licensed establishments to purchase alcohol. If our decoys are successful in being served, we arrest the server under the authority of the statute, or arrest 471-410, which Senate Bill 948 will amend and, in our opinion, strengthen. As a result of our efforts in this arena, we've noticed a greater awareness and compliance among licensed establishments within our city. Our compliance rate has increased dramatically since we started this program, which means that we've gotten the attention of at least the retailers in our jurisdiction. The provisions included in Senate Bill 948 are a logical next step in the overall statewide underage alcohol consumption policy, in my opinion. Current law calls for an increasing fine schedule upon each conviction for supplying alcohol to minors. Although this has been a workable punishment, its three-strike philosophy doesn't seem to be much of a deterrent to the 70% of the people who we know through studies supply alcohol to minors, and that's their family and friends. The fines laid out in this statute are, in this day and age, very affordable to most offenders, especially when payment schedules are factored in. Once convicted, offenders pay a fine and may receive informal probation and then go on about their daily business. I don't think that's much of a trade for the potential damage that furnishing alcohol to a minor it could cause. We need more of a bite and deterrence built into the current statute, and I believe that the provisions in Senate Bill 948 provide this. We're all relying upon our vehicles and the privilege of driving them in order to go about our everyday lives. I'm sure that everybody drove here today in order to do that. The privilege is often taken for granted, especially by young adults who I know, based upon my experience, to be the most likely to purchase alcohol for younger family and friends. I believe that the additional provisions of license suspension via Senate Bill 948-2, current state statute, will make those who are most likely to purchase alcohol from younger family and friends think twice about the ramifications associated with purchasing and supplying alcohol to minors. I believe that the loss of one's driver's license will have the most cost-effective, significant, and profound impact upon those who would buy or provide alcohol to underage residents of my city, my county, and all of our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next we'll take Kelly Sky and Steve Lanning.
Welcome, members of the committee. Kelly Sky, appearing. I'm legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I almost announced myself as though I was appearing in front of a judge.
You are.
I've been waiting all session for that, please.
Your Honor. OCDLA objects to the provisions in Senate Bill 948. We're not here to talk about underage drinking, but our concern is that this punishment, suspending driver's license, doesn't have a sufficient nexus to the underlying behavior. We don't agree with suspending licenses as a punishment for crimes that are unrelated to driving. And this is one of those situations. People use their cars for a number of things. Some people don't have licenses, so you can have a sort of a disparate impact. If someone doesn't have a driver's license, this isn't going to be a punishment to them at all, whereas if someone has a driver's license and uses their car for work, to transport their children, for medical appointments, for all types of things, then it's a very severe punishment. So it's really got a disparate impact in its application. Especially in a state like Oregon, where we have many rural areas that do not have public transportation, this can have a significant impact on people. And because it's not related at all to driving or to the privilege of driving, you're not violating any of the laws surrounding driving, we disagree with its application. The other thing is that in the state of Oregon, we have an incredible amount of unlicensed drivers for all kinds of reasons. It's incredibly expensive to reinstate a driver's license, and what results from that is that we have unlicensed drivers on the road, and unlicensed drivers are uninsured drivers, and that places other licensed drivers at a risk if they are involved in an accident with an uninsured driver, that they may not be covered.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning, and I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I'm here today for one of our large union affiliates, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 555. They represent 16,000 workers in the state, and about 10,000 of them are grocery clerks. And they're very concerned about alcohol sales to minors, but the way that we read this bill without any amendments is that if they unknowingly make a sale to a minor and get caught in a sting, like an OLCC sting, but not only, it's not only a misdemeanor currently as it is now, and they could lose their job through the zero tolerance policy of the employer, but they could also lose their driver's license. And if the amendments that are coming exempt retailers and their employees, then we're okay.
Okay. It's my understanding that those amendments will be coming to exempt the people from the United Food and Commercial.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Did you say unknowingly?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, if employees unknowingly make a sale to a minor.
Madam Chair, I thought this bill had an element of knowingly in it.
It does, as does the criminal statute, but sometimes that's a matter of interpretation. I think that's what you were saying. They may feel that there may be a conviction in a case like that, and it does require it to be knowing for there to be a conviction. But I think you were addressing the fact of having this additional penalty.
Yeah, and I think this bill is how you interpret this bill and this section of the law, that the grocery union is very aware of it. They don't support the current penalty. They'd like to see it lessened, but the way that they're looking at this, that it could apply to them as well. And that's why if there is an amendment that exempts retailers and their employees, that would be fine.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll just have to see this because if the amendment deals with people who knowingly sell, they shouldn't be exempted.
Well, but I think the point was for the amendment that there are other statutes to penalize retailers, that the sanctions are more, they're criminal sanctions. So this would not be something on top of that. Whereas a regular person, help me out here, counsel, just an ordinary citizen would not have the same kind of statutory sanctions against them. Thank you very much. Are there other questions in the committee? Thank you. Okay, now we will take Andy Jordan and Otto Schill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Werdick, members of the committee, my name is Andy Jordan, and I'm here with Otto Schill today. We're representing the Oregon PTA. The Oregon PTA is the largest and oldest child advocacy organization in the state. We're celebrating our 100th anniversary this year. And even though oftentimes people believe that we're all about fundraising for 100 years, we've been about advocacy and advocating for the health, safety, and welfare of children and families. And so we are here today in support of Senate Bill 948.
And it falls to me to talk about the bill more specifically. My name is Otto Schill. I'm with the Oregon PTA. In particular, I'm the legislative person for the Portland Council of the PTA, 10,000 members of PTA in Portland in particular. Thinking about coming to talk to you today about this bill, I talked to a lot of my friends who had teenagers. My son's on the younger end of the spectrum. I'm sure that these issues are in my future. One thing that came up over and over is just that people understand this as a more serious problem these days. You know, the societal tendency to treat it as a rite of passage that teenagers or young adults get alcohol underage. You know, we used to be a lot more casual about that, but then the consequences are what our community deal with. After the police and fire rescue people are gone, we're the members of the community that are dealing with the aftermath of what happens in alcohol poisoning, bad car accidents, sometimes fatalities. Over and over, young folks get in trouble because of alcohol drinking and possession, and we think that this is not an unreasonable approach to treat it as a more serious situation, to clarify the thinking of any adult that has a tendency to think that this is just okay. We think that this puts the teeth in the law that really will stop people that might be sorting it out, trying to decide if they're going to wink and nod at providing alcohol to young adults and teenagers even. So we're here to lend our support, and we think with the provisions that have been discussed today, we would be supportive of those changes to make things clearer, to exempt the people who need to be certain that they're not going to get crosswise with the law. This is really, in my understanding of the bill, it's targeted at the people who, young adults, 20-year-olds, who are buying alcohol for teens and even younger. So,
thank you. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I'm worried about ratcheting up penalties and the idea that, oh, we're sending a message, we're going to make these people think twice. I hear that over and over and over again, and, you know, I just have a hard time believing that people go, well, it's illegal, but now it's more illegal, and so I'll change my behavior. And if you're really focusing this on 20-year-olds, frankly, I think if they're caught and they lose their license, I think they'll drive without a license. And then what happens? And they get caught doing that, and then there's a further offense, and it becomes a spiral that sometimes I think leads to very unfortunate results, because we're in this mode of we got to crack down, and there's zero tolerance for any misconduct. And that's why I have no tolerance for alcohol and driving, but I think you can go too far the other direction, and I'd like to see something like this at least be a second offense.
Hey, Senator Ringo, Madam Chair, we were not involved in the drafting of that particular language. I understand your sentiment. I don't think it's misplaced. The interesting thing is, when we were gathering today to come talk to you all about this, we were discussing the fact that the college newspapers have picked up on this, and they understand this is different. Because it is different. It's back to the arguments that were made earlier about a driver's license is the keys to independence, to freedom, not just going to a job, but it's social mobility, it's status, it's all those things. So maybe it would be ratcheted up with, the suggestion being that there be flexibility for employment, but you don't want to ameliorate the impact too significantly, because a first-time offense, if they're clobbering you or me driving in our car, it doesn't matter if it's the first time they messed up.
I agree with that.
Because the consequences are prominent.
I agree with that.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Oops, thank you, both of you. Okay, Paul Cosgrove.
I can't see that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, and we fully support Senate Bill 948 with the amendments that have been discussed earlier. And much of what I was going to say has already been said, so I'll only make one point. I think it has been said in a different way. I think the difference between this bill and the monetary fines and other things that exist in current law for furnishing to a minor is the impact on most young adults of losing a driver's license, and the concern or fear of that, I think, is a substantial new deterrent, more so than a $350 fine. And so we think this is an important step in trying to have those folks who would furnish to a minor stop and think twice before they do so. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Let's see. We will now close the hearing on Senate Bill 948, and we will open a hearing. I'm going to skip that other one on 953.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 953 comes here for the Committee on Judiciary. Includes personal information about potential actual donors to the Oregon Health Sciences University within the current exemption for similar information concerning potential actual donors to the Oregon University system.
Okay, we have one witness signed up, Brian Beringer from OHSU. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Beringer, and I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University to talk about Senate Bill 953. That is right there. OHSU, along with Oregon University Systems, currently have public records exemptions for personal information for donors that may be contemplating making a donation or in the action of making a donation. The provisions are in 192.501.24, and the OUS provision is 192.501.25. What we're asking today is to basically just eliminate the OHSU provision and combine it into the Oregon University System provision. The Oregon University System provision is a little bit broader. It allows protection of not only information dealing with the donor, but other information dealing with the donor's family that's prepared by others outside of the university. Both the university system and OHSU have a strategic interest in protecting donor information. For example, the philanthropic community in Oregon is very small. There's a culture in Oregon of downplaying personal giving. Not only do they tend to be more modest, but also they have a pragmatic interest in protecting their information from other organizations that are out there. In respects to the Oregon Opportunity Program that OHSU embarked upon in 2001, our largest donor, a seven-figure donor, was a couple that actually wanted to make the donation in private and would not have made the donation if their information wasn't protected. The list of exemptions, as most of you know from us previously being before your committee in 192.501, is very long. Today we have an opportunity to shorten that by one. And so I would ask that the committee adopt Senate Bill 953 and send it to the floor. Happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I really hate exemptions to the public records law. You know that, Mr. Barringer. You took me off the floor this morning. In fact, you're the reason I was not on the floor to vote this morning because I got distracted.
I apologize.
There's that vote.
But you talked to me this morning. The Newspaper Association doesn't object. The ACLU doesn't object. Surprise, surprise. They feel the same way I do about public records exemptions. And this has already been in existence for the Oregon University System for some time?
I believe the provision for the university system was just created last session, and that's where we have the issue. Ours was created when we rolled out to the public corporation in 1995. Theirs was created when they did some modifications to their law last year. Theirs is, like I said, a little bit better. So we see with both the university system and OHSU have the same goal in mind and the same purpose for protecting those public records, that it should probably be the same provision rather than having two separate ones.
Okay. I probably voted for this exemption, Madam Chair.
Probably did, Senator Walker. I think I was there when that happened.
Senator Starr shaking his head like he remembers that, too. So I suppose there was some solid, sound reasoning for it.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I understand your hesitance with public records exemption. Let me just say that one of the good reasons for supporting this exemption is, as you're all aware, this current budget climate, now more than ever, the university system and OHSU is becoming more and more dependent upon private donations. And if there was a situation that prevented folks from donating to the university system or OHSU, we certainly wouldn't want that to be a barrier between them and us collecting some additional revenue.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm remembering this discussion I had with President Frohnmayer before last session began, and the issue where some of the donors just simply don't want people to know who they are, and it was impeding their fundraising ability. So
right.
Okay.
And that really says something about the donors, in my view, Senator Walker, that someone would want to support something and not be tooting their horn about it.
Mm-hmm.
Council.
Madam Chair, I think a strict reading of the current statute could result in this kind of anomaly, in the sense that a person sends a letter to Oregon Health Science University saying, I'd like to donate $100,000, and the university writes back and says, we'd be glad to accept it. The way I read it right now is a letter saying we'd be glad to accept it. They could exclude from our public records, but the letter going to them saying we'd like to donate it would not be excluded.
That's right.
Whereas if it were sent to the University of Oregon, all of that information would be excluded. I somehow don't think that was the intent when they originally wrote this exception. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Madam Chair, Council sums up the expansion into the university system very well. That's exactly the issue we want to be a part of.
Thank you. Senator Byer and then Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When does the sunset take effect in this statute? No, I'm really serious. The sunset wasn't part of the statute last session.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, actually, I think what you're looking at is there are two sections where the bill is amended. The first section is the current law. The second section is oral laws, and I'll let counsel speak to this. You can probably do it more eloquently, but my understanding is that that happens so that it can deal with the section of public records law that we actually happen to be involved with our other exemption, which, as you all know, has a sunset on it. And so thus the section of laws created plus the oral laws section is created so that that can be repealed when the sunset sets.
Okay, you have to run that by again. This has no impact on the sunset that we put on the other one, is that correct?
But Madam Chair, my question is I don't see a date in this bill under Section 2 as to when the sunset takes effect. So my question was when is the date?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, let me take another stab at it. There is no date for a sunset because this provision doesn't have a sunset on it. The provision that we dealt with on our other public records exemption has a sunset date, but that's in another section of law. Council can correct me if I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what you see a lot of, and this drives me crazy too, I read the bill, and I see like Section 2, and I'll see the amendment. Then I see the next section making the exact same changes, and I realize then I go back and says, for example, Section 2 as amended Section 3, Chapter 807, Oregon Laws of 2003. What the Legislative Council's office does is put the changes in both of those sections. And I think you'd have to go back to the 2003 law to see when the bill sunsets and to what particular section is being sunsetted. I could do that if Senator would like me to do so. But by putting it in both sections, it will be the law when this is adopted, and it will be the law when the sunset takes effect.
Okay.
And what happens is it goes back to the what it does, it goes back to the law before the sunset.
Subsection 26 in the first section of the bill is what sunsets out of it in the second section. But I'm just wondering when. I understand you're saying this bill will not, this section will not be opened at that case because
that's correct. Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Byer.
The way they do sunsets, I don't know that I'm ever going to understand it in this process. Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 953 and open a work session on Senate Bill 953. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 953 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 953 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Byer, would you like to carry this?
That's fine.
Thank you. You know, Senator Whitson, I just realized I think I overlooked one of your questions.
I actually found the answer to my question in the text while we were discussing
that's
it.
Very good. My apologies.
No problem.
Okay. Now we will open a... we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 113.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 113 comes to you from at the request of Governor Ted Kulongowski for the Department of Transportation. And Senate Bill 113 increases the number of years between certain convictions for persons who can qualify for driving while under the Intoxicants of Diversion Program. It increases from 10 years to 15 years. So if you want a diversion program currently now, it's 10 years before you're then again arrested. You would be eligible for a diversion program again. If this passes, it would then be 15 years. There are no amendments, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. There have been amendments proposed to this to lengthen the time period or even get rid of the time period and make the make only one diversion per life, literally, but it was kind of like Goldilocks and the porridge. Some of it was too hot, some too cold, and I thought the original bill got it about right, that would take into account, that would lengthen the period somewhat so that people couldn't just repeatedly get diversion, but leave some room for the very young person who messes up and lives a good life and maybe waits a very, very long time before messing up again. Anyway, so the way the bill stands right now is 15 years, and if Senator Starr is comfortable with that, I would wait for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 113 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 113 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Beyer?
An objection.
Objection? Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll be voting no as well.
Okay. Uh-oh. We got a problem here? Well, let's have a little discussion.
Conversation about it.
Pardon?
We want to have a conversation about it.
Okay, that's fine. That's why I asked for a discussion.
Yeah. I just have some concern about bumping it up to 15 years. I see in my notes that I had to leave at 2:55 at the last hearing, so I didn't get to hear from all of the witnesses. Kelly Skye testified that every session we address this and increase penalties, then at the same time we drop people from the Oregon Health Plan to provide treatment. I remember that conversation. Diversion was established in 1981 to reduce the burden on the court. We've changed diversion statute significantly since then. It's not a free lunch. I just have some concerns. I'd like to hear from my other colleagues who want to vote no.
Senator Beyer, why don't we start with you?
Madam Chair, you know, I understand the intent of the bill, but to me 10 years is a long time, and I haven't seen the compelling argument made to increase it by 50%. That's just where I am personally. I just don't see the need to increase the penalty or, you know, increase the time between them. I think, you know, just if someone happens to make it, you know, 10 years or 11 years, what's the magical number at 15? I mean, it's just where I am.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Well, Madam Chair, my sentiments are similar to Senator Byers and Senator Walker's. I think the DA say diversion is an effective program. They like diversion. It gets people into treatment. People drive drunk generally because they have problems with alcoholism and they need treatment. And on the one hand, we can't be too sympathetic. We need to get people off the roads. We need to suspend licenses. We need to punish. But I think 10 years is an appropriate amount of time. And if somebody has a problem and they reoffend, and they haven't reoffended in that length of time, then 10 years is the right number, and the moving out to 15 years doesn't serve us.
Okay. Other discussion? Senator Witt, what's it?
Well, actually, Senator Ringo just made my argument. I think that the diversion program is a means of getting people into treatment. And with alcoholic people, that's one of the, that is the single most important step in recovering, is getting them into treatment. So I would not support this bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. One of the other comments by Kamala Sugar at that hearing in February, she said it's not uncommon for someone to reoffend just outside the 10-year diversion period, but I don't really see anything in my file that shows me any numbers that would justify that comment.
Senator Zelensky. I'll follow up on that. Because Kamala Sugar, she did testify to that, and I can tell you from my experience, I've seen a number of people who have been just outside. I've also seen a couple that have been just inside the 10-year. Personally, I'm fine with the 15. I had some concerns when the Platts came to see me. We introduced Senate Bill 625, which would have been basically once in a lifetime, and I told them that it seemed like there would be a lot of difficulty. Of course, now we're talking about raising it for 10 years. I'm comfortable with if we moved it up to catch it. There is a window there, but it's one of those things that people can say. If you should take it to 15, do we now need to take it to 16 or 17? It's one of those things. I mean, what I'm seeing right now,
based on the numbers here, we have a constitutional issue here.
You are very astute, Senator Brzezinski.
Even I can count, right?
The other discussion. Senator Starr, I would welcome a motion to withdraw your motion.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
Constitutional problem. I withdraw my motion to pass a Senate bill. 113.
Senator Starr has recognized a constitutional problem and moved to withdraw his motion on Senate Bill 113. And we will close the work Senator presents.
I think the other thing I want to say before we go off the record on this bill did come from the governor's task force. And, you know, I guess in my discussions with the press, they understand the problems that we had with 625. And I think they were willing to accept, quote unquote, going to what the governor's task force said. But I want them to understand that this, you know, their position on their on the other bill does not have any impact on the decision of this committee regarding Senate Bill 113, because I know that they were concerned that they didn't want to see that jeopardized. But the reality, based on the configuration we have here, that bill stands on its own and has problems on its own.
Thank you for those comments, and this has been a good discussion. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 113. And we will open a work session on, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 114.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 114 comes to you at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski for the Department of Transportation. Increases the filing fee from $90 to $150 that a person must pay after being convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants for a screening interview to determine the person's addiction to drugs or alcohol and the appropriate treatment program.
Okay, we have signed up Sally Panna and Teresa Douglas on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Could I ask the council, when was the original $90? At what point in time was that established? The original $90 fee, when was that established?
Madam Chair, I did not quite hear the question, but I think it is kind of saying when was the last time the...
When was the $90 fee that's in the current bill, when was that established?
Madam Chair, I members of the committee, Senator Wilson, I am not that sure. What I can do is check the ORS and tell you when the last time the bill was amended. I'd have to go back to each one of them and then establish in what year it was done. Maybe the witnesses know that information.
It's been the last 10 years.
Senator Podansky, did you want to put that on the record?
I think we can get from the witnesses, but I know it's been in the last 10 years, and we've had it set up two different ways. One would be in the statute as to how much had to be paid for the court, and sometimes it goes to the assessor. There's been a lot of configuration, so there's been some changes that have been made. But I think it's been, maybe I have to just let the testimony come in, but I know we've seen a change within 10 years. I think it was like 97 or 99.
Let's start this discussion.
Now we'll see.
Thank you.
Committee members, my name is Teresa Douglas. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUAI. I've been an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist since 1984. And excuse me,
could you speak just a little louder into the mic? Thank you.
Thank you. Before I start my testimony, I will answer your questions, Senator Brzezinski and Senator Whitsitt. According to the evaluators that we have consulted, the evaluation fee was last increased in 1989. There was a change in the 90s that changed it from the clients paying the court and then the courts dispersing the fee to the evaluators. They now pay that fee directly to the evaluators for the services. Evaluation specialists, alcohol and drug evaluation specialists, are certified by the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and were designated by our courts to provide the DUAI services to that court. We provide many essential services to the courts and the clients and the public. We do an initial screening. We monitor the client throughout the time that they're in their treatment. We monitor their compliance with diversion requirements. We report to the court, good and bad. We also are required to testify in court on occasion. We also consult We also consult with the treatment agencies on a regular basis when there are problems with clients who are not complying, and we intervene in an attempt to get the client to comply and to complete their treatment successfully. We're basically kind of on the front line. We're required to make sure that the client's DUI diversions and convictions complete their treatment requirements and also notify the court anytime they don't. In 2001, the administrative rules were changed, which required us to also provide these monitoring services for DUI convictions that do not have probation officers. They're basically on a bench probation, and we did not receive any additional compensation for that additional services. As I'm sure you know, the cost of providing these services has increased significantly since 1989. Most of us are private entities and are required to pay, rent and support staff and all of those charges. And we're also required to provide interpreters for those that do not speak English, and that's at our own expense. We also provide services to offenders that live outside the state of Oregon and receive their DUIs within the state. So we also work with treatment agencies that are outside of the state. And we also have to make sure that the out-of-state offenders comply with Oregon requirements and fulfill their requirements for their DUI diversions and convictions. As you know, the budgets for the courts have been increasingly shrinking, and the evaluation specialists are stepping in and doing a lot more services for the courts that we are not receiving compensation for. I know in several counties the evaluation specialist is also asked by the court to make sure that the clients attend a victim impact panel, and we're required to monitor that as well as the diversion requirements. The evaluation specialists are also a source of knowledge to the public and to the clients. A lot of times we are the person that informs them as to their requirements for diversion, informs them about their license suspension, and we provide that information to the public anytime we're asked as well. We provide an essential service, and as you know, the cost of providing that service has increased since 1989. These fees are only paid by those that make themselves subject to the law. They're paid by the offender directly to the evaluation specialist. There is no impact on any state or county budget with regard to this fee. Therefore, we would ask that you would pass this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and take any questions.
Thank you. How do you handle people who are unable to pay? What happens then?
Madam Chair, many evaluators do allow clients to pay lower fees. There's no requirement in the statute that we charge that fee. For myself, as a courtesy to my clients and my courts, I do charge a lower fee for those that are food stamp eligible. And I know there's several other evaluators around the state that do the same.
But if someone wanted to really kind of drive a hard line and they couldn't get the evaluation, they couldn't pay for the evaluation, what then?
I know that in my personal case, I work with people as much as possible. I allow them to make payments. If it comes down to where the client is just refusing to pay and they just are not making an effort, then at that point they have to go back to the court, and the judge then discusses the situation with them.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sally Penna, and I'm also an ADIS here in Oregon.
Can you pull the microphone down a little closer? There you go.
I've been an ADA since 1981, since the program began. I remember when I received my first training by the state, they told us at the time that we would never be rich being an ADA, but they did not tell us that we were going to go broke. And that's what's happening now, because our fee has not been raised for 16 years. I believe that the state of Oregon was very creative and innovative and fiscally responsible when it created the ADIS position back in 1981. The position was designed to cost the state nothing. The entire fees were to be paid for by the offender, which is as it should be. But unless this bill is passed, ADSs will continue to do what they have been for some time, and that is personally subsidizing each DUI offender that comes before them. If this continues, more ADSs will be forced to quit their positions. And when an ADS leaves the job, the work is still there. Somewhere, somebody has to do it. If the funding does not change, the job will inevitably revert back to the state because nobody will be willing to work for this fee. If the state is forced to assume the role, the cost of doing the ADIS job will not be $150 per offender, paid for by the offender. Instead, it will require the state hiring full-time employees with buildings and benefits, including PERS and medical coverage, at a much, much higher cost, whether through the courts, corrections, or some other state entity. The good people of Oregon at that point will be providing the offender's subsidy. One last note. Last legislative session, a similar bill to increase our fee was introduced but ultimately did not pass. It appeared initially that it would, overwhelmingly, but unfortunately an unrelated amendment was attached to it, which cost the bill the support required to pass it. I would ask that you please make sure that this bill does not become similarly encumbered. This bill has been labeled an emergency measure for good reason. Thank you for your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'll address them.
Thank you. Council?
Madam Chair, I just went down the audience to have a discussion with Kelly Sky because I think it would be helpful if she came up and testified, because I know that, for example, you cannot be denied access to a diversion program based on indigency. That's constitutional, and I just had a discussion with her, and I think she can relay some additional information on that, and I think that also applies to an assessment to go into a program.
Come on up, if you're willing, Ms. Sky. Thank you. Before Kelly starts talking, are there questions from either of the people who just testified? Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Kelly Sky with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And prior to this hearing, I did call a pro tem judge in Oregon, or in Multnomah County, who just finished the diversion rotation, because I knew that he'd had hearings on this issue. And he informed me that there is a Court of Appeals case, which I can get for you, which does state what Counsel Taylor just mentioned, that a person cannot be denied treatment, services, due to inability to pay, because there would be an equal protection argument there, that diversion was only available to the rich. And in response to that Court of Appeals case, he says by administrative rule that there is a requirement that when the state contract with these treatment agencies, and I am assuming that includes the assessors, that part of their contract provides that they must provide for inability to pay based on presentation of documentation that they're eligible for food stamps or subsidized housing. There were a list of things. So, you know, in speaking with him, he felt that it was adequately covered by administrative rule. You know, it's not something that the court can waive at this point because it's not in the statute. You certainly could put it in the statute so that the court actually has that inquiry and determines whether it's waived, but right now it's supposedly a provision within the contracts with these agencies.
Okay, and did you have any comment on what happens if they can't afford to do it anymore, about it going back to the state? And I mean, this is a required function, so is that the same way you see it, that the state would have to do it if these folks couldn't afford to do it anymore?
Oh, Chair Burdick, you mean if we no longer contract with assessors and just have the state do it?
Right.
Right now it's required by statute, so I think it would need to be done by someone, and quite frankly, I'm not in a position to say who would actually do that. I know that that there's a policy, and it's actually in the statute, that requires or has a goal of having a different agency provide the screening than the agency who's going to provide the treatment, so that there's not a temptation to refer everybody to expensive treatment because you're then going to make money off of that treatment. And I think that that's a good policy. But, you know, if the assessor was a state employee as opposed to a separate contractor, I couldn't say what sort of impact that would have.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Bullock, Ms. Guy, I guess I'm a little lost what the discussion is really about here, because if a person were able to pay $90 16 years ago, that isn't even to keep up with inflation rates, so we really haven't changed anything when you're talking about real dollars. As a matter of fact, it's at $150, it would be less expensive now using real dollars than it was in 1989.
And Chair Bullock, that's part of the reason why we didn't come out and object, so long as we know that there's a way for the agency or the court to take into consideration inability to pay. It makes sense that you would need to adjust fees. Thank you. Okay, is there Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for counsel. Again, we see a weirdly worded sunset or something in the law. If you look at this, if I'm looking at sections 2 and 3, where section 2, there's a sub 3, there's a $71 surcharge through this biennia for this, but in section 3, that surcharge is gone, but the fee is increased by $24, distributed to ORS 137,295. Could you tell us what those are and what's happening there and when?
Madam Chair, maybe if you give me a few moments, I can, but I think Senator Beyer is right that that's probably part of the sunset provision on the bill, that whenever this particular amendment sunsets, it could be this year, it could be 2007, usually it's the end of June, beginning of the next biennium, that the surcharge the court shall collect. Ending, yes, well, in addition to a fine fee, the period commenced in September 1, 2003, and ending June 30, 2005, the court shall collect a surcharge of $71 upon the filing of a petition for driving while under the influence. If my memory serves me correctly, that may have been tied into part of the bill that we passed last session, the legislature passed last session, as it relates to surcharges and fines, fees, and assessments. You may remember that bill towards the end of last session. And I think it had a two-year sunset provision. There was, among other things, I think a revenue issue involved there as it relates to the courts and criminal justice system.
So the way I'm looking at this, and I'm assuming, Madam Chair, that at some point in time in the future, and that's my question is exactly when, I guess, if you look at Section 3, that surcharge goes away, but the sub A under 1 raises from $112 to $136.
Whoa. Subsection A under section
3.1A becomes $136, where it is currently $112.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator, you got me stumped. I mean, I look at the changes in the law, and I don't, and the policy, I don't oftentimes look at the what we already have there. And
maybe let's go ahead and Ms. Guy, did you have something to add to this?
Chair Bullock, members of the committee, and Senator Beyer, last year there was a giant bill which raised fees, filing fees, and maximum fines, and basically every monetary value attached to the court system. And many of the provisions did it this way, so that there was a surcharge for one biennium to be replaced with an increased filing fee after that. And I do recall it was a revenue, it was a revenue issue. So this isn't the only fee that was imposed on. It was imposed on every diversion, every filing fee, every court fee.
Counsel?
No, Chair, Senator Barr, you seem to be, I think you're correct. I mean, it looks like that in reading the sunset provision above, in June 30, 2005, at least the surcharge will end, but it does appear on the other part of the bill, if that in fact takes effect, we go back to it in June 30, 2005,
the fee will go from $112 to $136.
Okay, guess what? We're going to ask somebody from Legislative Council to come up who drafted this bill, because that's a technical question. It's a drafting question, and we'd like to get it answered.
Madam Chairman, let me. I will go to the laws from last session and pull these particular statutes and bring them out, and maybe that will give a better explanation. It may also require me to pull up the staff measure summary from the bill from last session, because this was an issue, if I remember correctly, started out in one bill on the, and then got switched to another bill, and it was one of these bills that I think it was in the closing days that it passed out of Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, so what does this mean? When can we figure out what's going on with this bill?
I'll go run now and pull the statute from last session and see if I can give any.
Okay. Senator Pisanski.
Yeah, I guess I apologize. I was out, so I didn't hear the question. But, I mean, if we're looking at Section 3 on page 2 and we're looking at the breakout of those expenses, that's the amount that's paid for the diversion itself, the 261, that breaks out those three portions that equal the 261. And then on the emergency clause, if the question is why it's starting on July 1, I would assume that's the fiscal start of the county mm-hmm. and the state, mm-hmm. and they're just setting it up where it will be in line with the with the fiscals for the counties. That's
I guess the question I had for you, Senator Beyer, is I don't understand this relationship between the 136 and the 112.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't either. That's the question I want answered. The question is,
where's the 112?
I guess the real question is, when does that happen? When does the 112 go to the 136? Because I can't determine that by reading this bill.
Okay.
At some point in time in the future, I think, is when that happens. I just don't know when that is.
Okay, well, council is going to do some brief research on this while we move to our different bill. If we can bring this back today, we will, and if not, we'll hold it. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 114, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. And since we have no counsel here to summarize 368, I will tell this. It prohibits the audiovisual recording in a movie theater of the movie being exhibited on the movie screen without the written consent of the theater owner. And to introduce this bill, we will call on too many papers up here. Amy Isbell from the Motion Picture Association. Mr. Hughes, did you want to come up as well? Ted, did you want to come up as well? Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Isbell, and I'm the Vice President of State Legislative Affairs for the Motion Picture Association of America. We represent the seven major movie studios with names that you're all familiar with, Disney, Fox, MGM, Paramount, Sony, Warner Brothers, and Universal. I am here today as proxy for Warren Beatty, who unfortunately was delayed on his flight and could not make it, Madam Chairman, but Ted Hughes did put in the request. So.
Are you serious?
I know, I'm such a poor replacement. But
I told them, no Warren Beatty, no bill.
I'm definitely cheaper.
Well, I have no vote then.
Me too, Senator Walker. Anyway,
I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to discuss our strong support for what we believe is a very simple and straightforward bill. We strongly support Senate Bill 368 and the Dash 1 amendments. And working hand-in-hand with our partners in the theater exhibition community, we have now passed similar statutes in 22 states plus the District of Columbia. We just added Idaho last Friday. More and more, as hard as it is to believe, there are now thieves just wielding simple camcorders in the movie theaters you go to all the time to see movies who steal the movies from the movie screen. It's crazy, but 9 out of 10 of the bootleg movies that you might see on a street corner, for example in Portland, come from the use of a camcorder in a movie theater. Now, if it was just this sort of hard goods kind of piracy, which generally is estimated to cost our industry about $3.5 billion a year, that would be one thing. But it's not just the street corners of urban areas such as Portland that witness this problem. The pirates take the movie with a camcorder, they upload it to an internet, and suddenly it's available all around the world for free. Pirates in places such as Russia or China or India will take the movie down off the internet and burn these copies. And in those parts of the world, we have over a 95% piracy rate. Because of the way our business works, a movie is first exhibited domestically before it goes international. As a result, we have severely damaged and handicapped the international market for movies made today. Obviously, if we could just stop the camcorder pirates here in the U.S. from the get-go, we've gone a long way in solving this problem. But this is a pretty sophisticated group of individuals. And considering they make about 8 times the profit margin of a drug dealer, more and more people are getting into the business. There are laws on the books now in Washington State and in California. We just passed one in Idaho, and we're working on one right now in Nevada as well. And we're concerned that unless we pass one in Oregon, while we don't have a huge problem here now, without a law in the books, theater owners will be unable to call the police and ask for assistance when they catch one of these individuals, and police officers will be unable to detain or arrest such a thief. We believe it makes perfect sense, just as retailers have at their disposal shoplifting laws that protect them from theft, theater owners should have the same sort of protection on the books. The trial lawyer representative approached me before the hearing and raised a question about the immunity language in this legislation. The immunity language affords the theater owners protection from civil action if they stop and detain someone while waiting for the police to come. And our intent with that, just to be clear, is to mirror what is on the books currently for retailers and shoplifting. And again, I want to say that we strongly support the Dash 1 amendments, which we believe are necessary because Senate Bill 368 was drafted to amend your existing state statutes. And we want to make sure these are technical, non-substantive amendments that make sure they do not contradict existing federal law. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. It's my understanding that you're working with the trial lawyers on an amendment to solve some of their concerns over the immunity language.
Exactly. We'd be happy to do that.
Okay. And that appears on page 2 starting at...
It looks like what they've done is take section 131.655 and rewritten it to include theater owners and not just merchants. And what we will do is work with the trial attorneys to make sure that we're not changing existing law.
Correct. Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. How would you discover someone is doing this in the theater? I mean, I would assume, like, for instance, cell phones have cameras in them, and they're very, very small these days. You can hide them in your hand. Are you searching people when they come in, or how do you know that someone is doing this?
Well, it's a very good question. First of all, any theatrical print in release today is watermarked. So when we find one of these on a street corner or when an illegal file is found on the internet, we can determine what theater that was recorded in. So by identifying that source, we are working hand-in-hand with the theater owners to beef up protections in that particular location. We're most concerned about movies that are shown pre-release in a promotional type of setting. For example, you know, a radio station might give away free passes to see a movie that's opening next weekend. There's no admission charged. People come in. It's pre-release, so obviously getting a recording of that movie would have great, you know, black market value. And at those instances, the studios and theater owners work together to have special security there. You may, if you've ever gone to one of those screenings, you may be wanded or, you know, your bag may be checked. We are doing a lot of work in training theater owners and law enforcement and prosecutors about what they can do, and there's all kinds of tips. You know, everyone, somebody comes in an overcoat and it's 110 degrees outside, chances are maybe you should be a little suspicious. We have night vision goggles at screenings that have been identified as high risk to help us locate cameras.
How do those work?
It's the military technology. So someone will stand at the front of the theater with their back to the screen off to the side, and using the night vision goggles, they'll be able to actually see someone holding the camera. I mean, the problem that we have is some of these cameras are so sophisticated. We've seen them hidden in baseball caps or in their rose on their lapel.
We were wondering what that rose was.
You're all being recorded, but I'll get your written consent first. It's a very sophisticated operation, and because of that, we really want to make sure our theater owners have the protection they deserve. We, as the movie studios, have protections afforded to us under federal copyright law.
Mm-hmm.
But a theater owner doesn't. They have no recourse. And just as it's wrong to take a DVD out of a Hollywood video, it should be wrong to take a movie from a movie screen.
Senator Walker?
Madam Chair, I agree 100%. The thing that I just don't want you coming in here in the future is telling me that now you want to start warning people before they go into a theater. We don't even do that in our capital, much to my chagrin. So, you know, I appreciate hearing about some of the things that you're doing to prevent that sort of thing from occurring. And I did not know about the watermark, so that tells me that if you start finding a lot of bootleg copies coming from a particular theater in Philadelphia or someplace, and you hone in on that theater and you say, look, you've got concerns here and
exactly.
You need to beef it up. So I don't mind that, and I appreciate that you're doing that. I like the prevention angle rather than always the sanction angle.
Right.
So
we agree. I mean, we want the movie-going experience to remain a positive one, a fun one. We don't want people to come into theaters and see security forces.
Right.
That certainly does not serve our interest. So to do that, we want to make sure that we have the kind of laws in place that don't require that type of technological security.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 368? Okay. Thank you. We will wait for the amendments and we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 368. We will put over Senate Bill 114 to tomorrow's meeting and hopefully have an explanation of some of the technical aspects of that bill. And we will adjourn Senate Judiciary. Senator Pazansky?
9:40. Can we do something with it already?
9:40
is the foreclosure sale.
Oh, you know what? I forgot 9:40 because I had it listed, and then thank heavens I didn't gavel us out yet. We will open a quick public hearing on Senate Bill 9:40. Thank you, Senator Pazansky.
Would have had a couple upset customers here.
Yeah, I'll bet we would have. Senator Pazansky, would you summarize this bill, please?
Oh, sure, Madam Chair. What Senate Bill 940 would do, it would allow a farmer owner of whose property has been foreclosed and sold in a foreclosure sale for failure to pay an irrigation district assessment 90 days to redeem the property by paying all costs incurred by the district, including the unpaid assessments cost of foreclosure. It would allow their heirs, devisees, and grantees of the former owner, holders of equitable or legal title and liens upon the land, to exercise the right of redemption. It also applies to foreclosure sales after the effective date of this act.
That was brilliant. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pazansky and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress this afternoon. With me is Anita Winkler. She's Executive Director of the Congress, and we're here. Hopefully, between the two of us, we can answer your questions. The Water Resources Congress is primarily a voluntary association of special districts that are formed specifically to deliver irrigation water. Senate Bill 940 was drafted at our request
to make existing irrigation district lien foreclosure processes more equitable by providing the landowner and other lien holders a reasonable opportunity to redeem the land from foreclosure after the sheriff's sale of the property, and also to simplify the foreclosure process by allowing the sheriff to set the date of the sale. ORS 545-502 requires that the, quote, sheriff shall issue deed to the property immediately following the sheriff's sale of the property, and it specifically says that there is no right of redemption following the sale. Most judgments foreclosing a district's assessment lien are for amounts substantially less than the fair market value of the land. Experience has shown that people, including sophisticated lenders, do not always appreciate the fact that they will lose their land or the lien against the land if they do not pay the district's charges prior to the sale. Often full realization of this fact comes upon receipt of the sheriff's notice that the land has been sold and a deed has been delivered to the new owner. The landowner or creditor's only remedy is to file a motion with the trial court asking the court to set aside the sale as being inequitable. In some cases, the court has found that the price paid at the sale was so low as to be inequitable. In all cases, the court, the landowners, the creditors, and the districts incur substantial time and expenses in providing a post-sale redemption period. Senate Bill 940 would provide needed equity by allowing the landowner and other creditors a period of 90 days after the sheriff's sale to redeem the land from foreclosure. Senate Bill 545-502 now also requires that the court set the date and the time of the sheriff's sale, and its sale must be within 30 days of entry of the judgment foreclosing the district's lien. The statute also requires notice of the sale be published in the local newspaper for 2 weeks before the sale. Therefore, prior to providing the judgment to the court for signature, a date and a time for the sale must be established with the sheriff's office so that it can be included in the judgment form. Then the judge must sign the judgment form in a timely manner so the sheriff can arrange for publication and mailing of the notice as required by law. And then finally, the sheriff must conduct the sale on the date and the time set in the judgment. So, if the court is delayed in signing the judgment, or if the newspaper fails to publish the notice, or if there's an error in the notice that was published and a corrected notice must be republished, or if the deputy is ill on the date of the sale, or if there's an emergency in the sheriff's office which prevents the sale at the scheduled time, then the sale cannot be held at the time established by the court. And believe it or not, all of these scenarios have actually occurred in the last 3 years. The only remedy on this occasion is to file a motion requesting a supplemental judgment establishing a new date and sale time. New notice must then be published, posted, and mailed by the sheriff, all at significant expense. Senate Bill 940 would instead allow the sheriff to set the time for holding the sale rather than the court, thus allowing the sheriff to continue the sale to a date certain in the event that a sale could not be held at a scheduled time. This change also allows the district, the landowner, or creditor to negotiate a postponement if a short period of time is needed for redemption of the land prior to the sale. The existing requirement that a court set the time for the sale is unnecessary, at times it's cumbersome, and causes significant expense if a problem arises during the sale process. You have before you a set of -1 amendments, which were also requested by the Water Congress, because Senate Bill 940, as drafted, provides that the person who redeems the property shall pay all costs owed to the district related to that property. However, the redemption is from the foreclosure sale, where it's likely that the purchaser actually paid more than just the amount owed to the district. Therefore, as is the case in a mortgage foreclosure and other sheriff sales, the redemption price should be the amount paid by the purchaser at the sheriff sale plus interest and the amount of any real property taxes the purchaser paid following the sale. The purchaser at the sale is thereby made whole. Thank you for consideration of this measure and the -1 amendments. I would just like to say that my comments were greatly enhanced by Bill Ganong, who's on our board and an attorney out of Klamath Falls, who couldn't make it here today, but Anita and I will do our best to answer your questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Questions?
Question.
Madam Chair, I'm just not familiar with this process as to how it pertains or how it's similar to any other type of foreclosure sales where there would be redemption. And I just want to make sure before we move something like this that we actually have continuity or consistency to other farms that are used, so we don't set up multiple standards that's going to make it more confusing and arbitrary, and you know, one having 90 days, the other one maybe only having 30. I don't know what the other animals that might be out there that could deal with foreclosures and redemption. So I just wonder if you can give us any clarity.
Gotcha. Chair Buddick and Senator Pozanski, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. And I'm afraid you're probably going to get us in over our head on foreclosure law. It's our understanding that the anomaly in the past was actually the irrigation district law as written, because it provided no right of redemption at all. So we're trying to correct that. The 90 days, I'm not sure. I would like to say that came from other statute. I can't say that. I know we talked about everything from 30 days to 6 months and looked for something that we thought would be fair for the mortgage holder, fair for the property owner. In some cases, that farmer needs to redeem the property and get back to work farming, so we didn't want it to be so long that they put their income at risk. And it just was one that when we worked it through, it seemed like it would work based on irrigation district's experience in these situations.
I concur with Senator Pozanski. It should be connected to something. As I recall, I believe I met the lawyer that you were talking about, and as I recall, it was some time ago, but as I recall, it was tied to a similar foreclosure process in another, for other types of property. Perhaps you could provide the committee with a memorandum explaining the rationale of the way you structured it and what it's tied to, and if it's consistent to other foreclosure processes, and then we can move ahead with this.
Madam Chair and members, I would be more than happy to do that. I would just like to point out, I think the anomaly is the Irrigation District Statute Foreclosure Proceedings, which actually specifies that the proceeding shall follow the general procedure of a suit in equity, and then it starts adding some other criteria and specifically says at the bottom that no right of redemption thereafter shall exist. So I'll find this site to give it to you and provide a memo for all of you to show where it's consistent with other foreclosure statutes, just to provide an opportunity for landowners to resolve this issue rather than losing their property.
One other request, Christine. I guess that if we have this duty going to be delegated to the sheriff, what, if any, parameters does he or she have as to, I know it says it has to be done within 30 days, but if you're talking about extensions, my only concern is that at some point you have adversary positions that are going to want to get closure. And I think we just want to make certain that we have something that's uniformed, that you're not going to see 36 different rules imposed or considered, and making sure everyone, whoever they are going to be treated fairly and equitable, so one farmer doesn't find out that they get the extension and another one doesn't. You know, some type of guideline, how they're going to set that stuff up. So maybe there's something already out there. It just seems, knowing that it appears that we're going into a new arena for land that could be subject to foreclosure for irrigation districts, and let's just see if we can make sure we don't really start a whole new chapter of law that's outside of other foreclosure area.
Thank you. Our goal really is to provide the same opportunities to resolve issues as other foreclosure statutes provide, and not to increase complexity or differences among foreclosure statutes. So we'll look that up and provide you all memos.
Okay, I appreciate that. And along these lines, you know, to give us the justification for having the sheriff do it, because I share the concern that we don't want 36 different processes here. So if other foreclosure statutes use the sheriff in this way, that would be helpful for us to know. And if others, you know, continue to have the court do it, then we may want to go in that direction.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Mitt, some of the irrigation districts have in the past attempted to assert a shared ownership of their patrons' water rights. How would this change in the statute affect that if it were to come to pass that the courts were to hold in the future that the districts actually did have a shared ownership in that water right?
Chair Burdick and Senator Wixit, this bill refers back to ORS 545-494.
not because I anticipated your question, because I knew I wouldn't have the answers. That ORS is specific to an unpaid charge as a lien on the land. It ties only to the land, only to the real property. It has nothing to do with the water rights at all.
Well, there are those of us who believe that the water right is pertinent to the land and is part of it, and ownership part and parcel.
No, I understand that, but this is not unlike any other, say, a mortgage holder where somebody fails to pay the mortgage and the mortgage holder can foreclose. They can foreclose on the land, whether or not there's water rights there, depending on the situation. This is similar to where the district's assessments or incurred charges are tied directly to the land based on the acreage, and it goes back to this is how they lien the land. This is exactly what the Bureau does, the Bureau of Reclamation, is they put a lien on the land for the Bureau projects. So it's tied to the land. Maybe I'm missing your point from the way you're looking at me.
I'm sure.
Senator Whitsitt.
Again, the water right is pertinent to the land, and it's unclear to me how you could put a lien on the land without affecting the water right, because if you can no longer own the land, the water right can no longer be pertinent to that land.
Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsitt, is that working? One might argue, and you're getting into this whole other argument that I'm not sure this committee wants to get into, but one can argue that the ownership of the land can be separate from the holder of the water right, that a tenant could prove up the water right and hold it, and the owner of the land didn't have anything to do with it, and that's been part of this other whole discussion. So we have a disagreement to some degree about that ownership issue. The appurtenancy itself, the water remains appurtenant to the land without regard to what's happening with that land. It can be severed through some other actions. In this case, you know, the experience that we've had is the district forecloses for literally a couple of $1,000, which when you're dealing with farmland isn't much based on the overall size. People want to redeem this. It's not that anybody's going to walk off with it. If the landowner doesn't step forward and redeem it prior to sale, it is usually the mortgage holder that steps up and buys it in foreclosure. The districts are not buying up this land, as far as I know. I've not been told of any district who's bought the land. There's always an exception out there. But this isn't about the districts buying the land to control the water rights. This is about the district getting paid for the services they've been providing through this through the foreclosure process.
I'm sure.
Senator Whitsitt.
This is probably getting a little off the point.
But
you just made my point, I believe. You can't transfer the land from one individual to another without transmitting the water right with it. And so, but this is a different, we're getting off the point here.
Yeah, maybe Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsitt, we might want to have a discussion. There are actually transactions going on right now where people are severing the water right from the land.
Thank you. Other questions from committee? We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 940, and we now have, we're going to briefly reopen the hearing on 114, Senate Bill 114. Council, do you have an answer to the technical question that came up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it would be best to bring up Dave Hendricks, who drafted the bill from last session, and I have the staffers or somebody that I get from Ways and Means, and it's somewhere here. I can't find it. Put my hand on it right now.
Mr. Hendricks, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Council. I take it the question relates to the numbers that are in H13-240 and Section 2 of the bill and how they work. Compared to Section 3, which is where the law will be on July 1st when the sunset provision goes into effect. So this was a very complicated court fee increase bill that we passed last session, and what you need to know is that the policy decision that was made was to increase fees by 30% for this biennium, for the 2003-2005 biennium. Then, after the end of this biennium, what will happen if nothing else, no other action is taken by this Legislative Assembly, is that the fees won't go back down to where they were before. They will go down to where they were before plus 10%. So, in other words, 30% increase for for the first 2 years, thereafter just a 10% increase in those fees. So it's a fairly complicated drafting proposal about how you're going to make that work. In addition, the other thing that they wanted to do was to take the fees from the 30% increase over the biennium and put it into a special account for court operations, which is why they were doing it. So the solution that they came up with was to do a surcharge on these fees for the two-year period. And on the numbers you need to look at on page 1 on line 30, you'll see the number of 237. That's the old fee that they used to charge for the petition for driving under the influence, for the diversion petition. What they did then was on page 2 at lines 9 through 12, they did a surcharge of $71. That's the 30% increase, and that's what went into the special account for court operations. Section 3 was intended to take back the surcharge, and it does that by eliminating Section 3. It goes away. So the $71, which was on top of the $237, disappears, but they still wanted to put back in the 10%. So what happens is that $237 that used to appear in subsection 1 of 813-240 becomes $261 in line 16. That's an additional $24, which is the 10% increase that goes into effect. The other policy decision that was made here was that, well, we've got an extra $24, and we have a distribution thing about where it goes, and that's it on page 2 at lines 2 through 5. The question was, what do you want to do with the increase amounts for these distributions? And I remember making a phone call on this to say, what do you want to do? And the solution was to give the full $24 to be distributed basically to the general fund under 137.295. That's on line 18 on page 2, where it goes up to 136. Used to be 112 up on line 2 under the old distribution formula. So, sorry, that's a long, complicated explanation for a short question, but that is what's going on in these sections.
Aren't you glad you asked, Senator Parker?
Who thought of this cockamamie scheme? I mean, this is ridiculous.
I believe this had something to do with the budget crisis we were in.
It's called waste dreams.
These people have no business dipping into policy like this. I mean, this is ridiculous. We couldn't even understand it.
This did come out of the Ways and Means Committee?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, yes, I believe that's where it eventually emerged. But yeah. It was a complicated structure for how they wanted to provide extra money for the two-year period, and yet they also wanted to have this continued 10% increase over in the long run, and that's where the complications come in when you look at these sections, as they flip back and forth and you can't follow why the numbers look the way they do.
Senator Walker, I'm told by counsel that this did in fact originate in the House Judiciary Committee.
Right, but we sent it down to Ways and Means and we plugged in the numbers.
Okay, Mr. Hendricks, before you leave, are you convinced within an inch of your life that this bill does one thing and one thing only, and that is raises the fee from $90 to $150 for these DUII evaluations?
Well, given the fact that I didn't draft this particular bill, it would appear to me that the two changes that I see merely change the fee from $90 to $150 for the fees for screening interviews of persons convicted of.
You are now part of the legislative history of this bill, Mr. Hendricks. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A round of applause for Mr. Hendricks. Okay. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 114, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 114. Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move Senate Bill 114 to the Senate floor with a new best recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 114 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Senator Byer objects. Okay, clerk, will you please call the roll?
I just objected.
You did, but, who knows? Today, who knows?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Pruszynski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
5 ayes, 1 nay.
Okay, Senate Bill 114 is passed before with a due pass recommendation. I will carry this bill.
I was going to suggest a House member who created this mess. Carry it, Madam Chair.
I don't know if we can get people from the Department of Corrections to come.
Okay. Judiciary is adjourned.